Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we discuss science, technology, and the future of our environment. TikTok CEO was front and center at President Trump's inauguration yesterday. Joining us now to discuss whether TikTok will be allowed to be used in the U.S. tomorrow, the next day, the day after that, is Will Oremus, technology news analyst writer for The Washington Post. Will, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
I'm going to ask you to make so many predictions today. So what's going to happen with the TikTok ban?
Oh, no, I hate predictions.
Right, I know. Well, okay, let's start with what's happening right now. If you open TikTok, it is there, correct?
That part I can do. Yeah, if you open TikTok right now, you will get a little pop-up message that says, "Welcome back. Thanks for your patience and support. As a result of President Trump's efforts, TikTok is back in the U.S." And this is the result of President Trump's executive order on his first day in office, which has extended the time for TikTok to reach a deal to remain in the United States by 75 days. It was supposed to end on January 19th.
So there was a lot of questions whether President Trump was allowed to do that, to make the extension. I guess it was in the law that he could extend it. He just couldn't override the law. Is that right?
Not exactly. So the law didn't make any kind of allowances for extending that period. What President Trump is doing is saying, okay, this law is on the books. Under the law, if you are a service provider, so if you're Apple and you host the iOS App Store, if you're Google and you host the Google Play Store, even if you're Oracle and you host the servers that TikTok uses to deliver data to American users, you could be penalized for working with TikTok after January 19th. That law is still on the books. That law is real. It is in effect. What Trump has said is he will not enforce that law for the next 75 days to try to give more time to work out a deal whereby TikTok would be sold to an American company, or Trump has suggested he would be open to a deal where TikTok's Chinese parent company, ByteDance, retains partial ownership, but an American company splits the ownership of TikTok with ByteDance.
Yeah, whenever he proposed the idea of splitting it, you know, the whole 50-50 deal, that made me think, because there was all these rumors that Elon Musk was going to buy it. So then it suddenly made me think, like, did Elon Musk not have enough money? He couldn't afford it, but he can go halvesies.
Yeah, I'm not going to rule out anything. As I said, I'm always wary of making predictions, but I think Musk buying TikTok or even half of TikTok is relatively unlikely. TikTok was very quickly to dismiss that rumor. It was anonymously sourced to sources in China. I'm sure Elon Musk's name has come up and may continue to come up in the discussions, but that one strikes me as unlikely. I think it's going to be very hard for President Trump to find a suitable American buyer for the company. You have to find a company that's willing to potentially share control, and then you have to get ByteDance to be willing to share control. And the Chinese government has said very clearly it has no interest in allowing ByteDance to sell TikTok to an American company.
Now, why did Trump do this? Why did he decide to try to save the app or delay the inevitable? Why did he want to step in?
Yeah, Trump's view on TikTok has been thawing over a period of years. If you remember, it was years ago, it was actually President Trump who first proposed banning TikTok or forcing it to be sold to an American company near the end of his first term. During the Biden administration, Congress got working on that, and they actually passed that law, and President Biden signed it. But in the meantime, President Trump changed his mind. He found that he had a fair amount of support on TikTok during his campaign. He was something of a TikTok star. He had the problems that he had with TikTok originally. He didn't like some of the criticism and activism against him that was being organized on there, but he now sees it as potentially an asset. And I think he also loves being in the role of deal maker. You know, he loves being the person who has some leverage, who can try to arrange some blockbuster deal. And then he could be seen as the person who saved TikTok, which potentially would make him even more of a hero to conservative users of that app in the United States.
Yeah, you can definitely see him thinking, I'm going to make all the young people like me because I'm going to save TikTok for him, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that's the messaging that you see on the TikTok app right now. I mean, TikTok is clearly doing its best to get on Trump's good side. And the CEO of TikTok was by Trump's side at his inauguration. So he's getting some free advertising on there right now.
So the security concerns that Trump had back in the day, or that the lawmakers had, the reason that they said that this was about security concerns related to TikTok and China's involvement, do those not matter right now? Or
yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I mean, several of the lawmakers who were instrumental in passing the law have insisted that it does still matter, and they've said that Trump doesn't have the power to just sort of unilaterally undo this law. There's a sort of a legal limbo for the companies we talked about who are supporting TikTok. Again, you have the president saying, go ahead, keep TikTok online. You won't get in trouble for it. But if you work in risk management for a giant corporation, doing something that is technically against the law can be a risk. You could still theoretically be held liable for it. So it's a weird purgatory that TikTok is in right now. But yes, the reasons that Congress gave for banning TikTok in the first place were, look, you've got more than 100 million Americans on this app. It's owned by China. China has laws that say that private companies operating in the country need to provide access to user data if the government requests it. That opens, again, a theoretical. It hasn't been proven that this has ever actually happened, but certainly opens a theoretical security risk for anybody who uses the app, and in particular for high profile people or public figures. Now, a lot of countries have addressed that by banning TikTok from government officials' devices, which the United States already did years ago, but Congress decided that wasn't enough. They were also concerned about the idea that the Chinese government could somehow manipulate TikTok's algorithm in a way that would favor Chinese interests and sort of, you know, brainwash the American public through what they see on TikTok. I think that's probably a bit more dubious, but there have been occasional reports that maybe, like, you know, the protests in Hong Kong, for instance, didn't seem to get a lot of play on TikTok. You know, maybe the Chinese government had something to do with that.
Now, TikTok users were quick to go off on lawmakers for banning the app in the few hours that it was gone. Then when it came back, you saw countless videos of people basically yelling at lawmakers. Here is user Bella Vandala as an example of one, and there were countless others. Let's listen.
If TikTok being banned does not radicalize you as an American citizen, you are intentionally missing the point, because it's not about TikTok. It's the fact that Republicans and Democrats across all legislative branches can expeditiously and unanimously pull together like never before and probably never again to streamline legislation banning a social media app while completely ignoring everything important to us.
So that's just one example of people saying, if you can pass a law and ban TikTok and then change it so quickly, then why can't we ban assault rifles? Why can't we fix grocery prices? Like, why can TikTok happen so quickly?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, TikTok didn't have a strong American constituency lobbying on its behalf, and being seen as tough on China is something that appeals to a lot of lawmakers of both parties. It's one of the few things that Democrats and Republicans were able to still agree on. I think people are not wrong to point out, though, that all the concerns that were raised about TikTok in terms of the security of Americans' data, in terms of algorithms that can manipulate public information and public opinion, all of those apply to many other apps besides TikTok. You don't have to be a Chinese-owned app to present a data security risk for your users. There have been many reports out there about users of American-owned apps whose data has been compromised or even just legally sold on the open market, and the Chinese government can buy that data. Mm-hmm. So there is a fair question there, but what's the point about banning this one app when you can't pass any sort of broader digital privacy legislation to protect Americans' data from all the other apps that are out there?
This is Tech Tuesday on All Sides, and we are getting the latest on TikTok with Will Oremus, technology writer for The Washington Post. So with TikTok being in the news a lot, some people did migrate to another Chinese social media app called Red Note. What was the appeal of Red Note, and do you think that it will also be banned?
Yeah, so in countries where TikTok has been banned, the biggest winner tends to be Instagram Reels. This is the copycat product that Instagram, which is owned by Meta, the same company that owns Facebook, launched after TikTok was first banned in India several years ago. India was the largest market in the world for TikTok. So when it was banned, Indians were in desperate search of an alternative. There really wasn't anything on the market at the time. So Instagram came out with Reels, which looks an awful lot like TikTok. And now Reels is the most popular short video app in India. It's a giant market there. That could happen in the United States, but there's also a lot of people who aren't, who, you know, have already tried Reels in the US at this point, and they prefer TikTok. They're looking for an alternative. They don't want to just use another product by the Facebook owner. And millions of them flock to this app you mentioned. It's called Red Note in English, or Xiaohongshu in Chinese. This is another Chinese-owned app. Ironically, this app is actually much more heavily censored than TikTok itself. I mean, TikTok, one thing that I think a lot of people don't realize is that TikTok doesn't operate in China. TikTok's parent company, ByteDance, has a different app called Douyin that operates in China, and that one is censored according to the restrictive speech laws of the Chinese government. TikTok is not censored by the Chinese government in the same way, but Xiaohongshu is. So if you go on there and try to discuss politics, that's not allowed under the rules, right? Or at least saying certain things isn't allowed. You can see when you sign up, it gives you options for what kind of stuff you're interested in. You can see this is clearly an app aimed at a Chinese audience. I opened it and signed up, and it was giving me options for sports to sign up to follow. And the options were badminton, table tennis, swimming. There was no football, no
Oh,
baseball,
wow.
no basketball.
Red Note
It's
was not ready for all this influx of Americans.
absolutely not ready. But it's been a funny thing as Americans have joined. There's been Chinese users on there offering Mandarin lessons, people joking back and forth about the differences in culture. But yes, this is a much more Chinese app than TikTok ever was.
Yeah, the language learning app Duolingo saw a 200% spike in US users learning Mandarin. Was that out of spite, or were they just saying, if you can't beat them, join them, let's learn Mandarin? I don't
That's
understand.
funny. I didn't know that, but it doesn't surprise me. I mean, these things trend on TikTok, and then millions of people go and do it. So I have no doubt that there were people on TikTok saying, now's the time to learn Mandarin, or maybe on Red Note, Xiaohongshu.
Right. So you mentioned India. Is TikTok still banned in India? It's still outlawed?
TikTok is still banned in India. And again, Instagram Reels has been the biggest beneficiary. The second biggest has probably been YouTube, which launched a product shortly after Reels called YouTube Shorts. That's another it's another product that's very much like TikTok. There are other countries that have banned TikTok and then gone back on it and reinstated it. Nepal is one of those, and Reels did really well while TikTok was banned. But I was talking to someone in Nepal the other day for my story, and he said, well, as soon as TikTok was legalized again, everybody flocked back to TikTok, and it's now back to being the most popular. So clearly, Reels is not for a lot of people, Reels isn't a perfect replacement for what they loved about TikTok.
Well, you don't like to predict, so I'm not going to ask you what's going to happen tomorrow. I guess we'll just wait and see with these 75 days. You'll have to come back in 75 days and tell us what happened, right?
Yeah, we don't know how it's going to play out, but I think it's likely that at least for the time being, TikTok will remain live. The really unpredictable part is whether a deal will end up getting done, and if a deal does get done, will it satisfy the critics of China in Congress? Will it hold up in court? And so I think that's really an open question.
Now, I want to ask you one last question. As a technology writer, what do you make of all these tech CEOs who were front and center at the inauguration events yesterday?
So I wrote a piece years ago. Not all the pieces I wrote years ago hold up well, but this one I think has held up. It was that it, the headline was something like, "Tech companies aren't liberal or conservative; they're capitalist. They want to make money. And right now, the way to make money in the United States is to be on the good side of President Trump. He is a person for whom politics is personal." He wants to wine and dine you at Mar-a-Lago. He wants to have an open line to give you a call if you're a powerful person. And if he doesn't have that, if he doesn't feel like he has you on his side or has your support, he will usually find ways to make your life much harder. And for a tech company, that means probably regulations that could really hurt your business. And so what we're seeing is the are the CEOs of most of the biggest tech companies lining up to donate to Trump's inauguration, to go to Mar-a-Lago, make that pilgrimage, kiss the ring, say nice things about Donald Trump, change their content moderation policies so that they're less restrictive, loosen their hate speech policies. Meta and Mark Zuckerberg have been among the most vocal about this, but My own newspaper's owner, Jeff Bezos of Amazon, was right there with Trump at the inauguration. So you're seeing them line up to stay on the good side of the person in power so that they can continue making hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah, and it just makes me wonder if they all like each other, because I would have to think that Mark Zuckerberg wants TikTok to go away so Instagram Reels will be more popular, right? But then he'll stand there and go to all the parties with the TikTok CEO.
He'll grin, and I think he'll grin and bear it,
Yeah.
because that's what you have to do. The stakes are very high for Meta in particular, because again, now Trump holds the power over whether Meta's biggest rival in the world gets to stay in the United States or not. He also holds the power over a lot of other things that affect these companies, including the antitrust lawsuits that are seeking to break them up right now that are moving through the courts. It's now his DOJ, it's his FTC that are prosecuting those antitrust suits. So, right now they're all lining up and smiling with Donald Trump. I think at, check back in 6 months or a year, there'll be some winners and some losers, in this shakeout.
Yeah, whenever I was younger and MySpace went away, if you could go back to my younger self and tell them what social media would look like now, I think that I would be shocked.
It has changed a lot, and it's going to keep changing. We're already seeing, as I mentioned, we're already seeing one of the biggest changes being that companies are really pulling back from content moderation, because the Trump administration has signaled that they could get in legal trouble for moderating content. In Trump's view, it's censorship, and he actually passed an executive order on his first day in office against what he calls censorship of social media. So, the landscape keeps changing.
All right, well, Will Oremus, we'll talk to you in 75 days when TikTok is still here or banned again. So,
I'll look forward to it. Thanks, Amy.
thank you so much. That's Will Oremus, technology writer for the Washington Post. And coming up, we're going to talk about esports at Ohio State University. That's when Tech Tuesday on All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
And you're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. And Ohio State football isn't the only sport at the university making headlines these days. Esports is seeing explosive growth around the country. Earlier this month, the campus hosted the first ever Scholastic Esports Awards. Joining us now is John Price, General Manager of Ohio State's Esports Program. Welcome to All Sides, John.
Thanks for having me, Amy. It's great to be here.
So for those right now who are wondering, what do you mean by esports? Can you explain what esports are?
Yeah, no, I'd be happy to. So esports is, the best way to describe it is just a competition using video games on a medium. Much like you have football, you're on a football field, or soccer, you're on a soccer pitch. We're just using video games as another way to do competition, much like for any traditional sport.
So before we talk about the recent event that you held, can you give us a sense of the growth of esports, both at the high school and college level? I mean, there's just more and more people playing and getting good at it.
Yeah, it really has seen just explosive growth. In the last 10 years, the first collegiate program started in 2014. There were about 20 or so in that first year. That number has grown to easily over 300 plus. And on the high school side, I've seen numbers that purport esports, there's about 10,000 plus high schools with some sort of esports club or team. And to compare that with football, since we have been talking about that, national championships and everything else, there's about 16,000 high schools with football programs across the U.S. So in a very small amount of time, this is a sport that has just grown across every level of education.
And are you seeing it be more than just clubs? This is not just clubs. This is actually organized. There's competitions, right?
Oh, yeah, exactly. There are national championships for a variety of the different titles that are in esports as well. There are full-ride scholarships offered by a variety of different institutions. Actually, Michigan State University just started offering partial scholarships for esports in the fall of 2023. So it just gives you an idea. And there are more coming every year, which is one of the great things about being a part of it, is you've seen a lot of growth and just the amount of different areas it's kind of become a part of on campus at every level.
So for parents who worry that their kids are playing too many video games, their kid can now say, but I can get a scholarship for this.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And it's amazing just how many parents have really jumped in and supported their kids as they kind of experience and go through this from middle school to high school to college.
What about Ohio State? Is Ohio State considered offering a scholarship?
No, not at this time. Mm-hmm. Though it's not, definitely.
I'm sure you're working on it, right?
My list of projects is vast, and it's definitely one of the ones that's on there.
And many states consider it an official sport, right?
Yeah.
What is it considered here?
So it is still considered an activity under the High School Association, but there is a what's called Esports Ohio, which is the kind of the organizing body that's at the high school level. And they actually, in the last year, were sponsored by the University of Cincinnati. They received about $120,000 for them to host, for the University of Cincinnati to host for the next 5 years, the high school state championships, actually. So it is starting to check off all those boxes. They need to become an official sport at Ohio, in the state of Ohio, but it's already become that in a few other states in the country.
Okay, like which ones?
Oklahoma comes to mind, mm-hmm. And let's see. I think the other one I'm thinking is might be Texas. It's been a bit. Every state's been treating it differently.
Yeah.
Every state at least has some organization now that's providing support for it and recognizing the hard work students are doing across those states.
In April of 2024, most of the Big Ten teams traveled here to Ohio State for a Big Ten Conference Championship. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, yeah. That was a really amazing endeavor we had. So it came out of almost nowhere, in the sense of we'd gotten together as many of the different directors and student leaders on campuses. To give you an idea, about half of the Big Ten schools, they're still entirely run student organizations. The rest are myself, they might have full-time staff or part-time staff running it. And we got everyone into a room, and it's like, well, we want to play ourselves just like we would for a basketball, football, hockey season. And from that spawned the Big Esports Conference, which is what we hosted the championship for back in April 2024. And we had over 200 participants from 13 of the Big Ten institutions here on campus competing for the title.
So what are they playing? Is it a specific game? Are they playing football? Or are they playing basketball? Like, what are they playing?
No, much like traditional sports, you have kind of the gambit. The big mm-hmm. titles that we were playing in this one were a game called Rocket League, which is, the best way to describe it is soccer with rocket-powered cars. Mm-hmm. A lot of fun. They play a game called Valorant, which is a first-person shooter. They play a game called Super Smash Brothers. It's the Nintendo fighter game that's out there. So a lot of fun in that one. And the last game they play is a game called Overwatch 2. So, and those are the same titles they're playing currently as well.
How do they decide which? There are so many video games. I'm like, why not Mario Party? Or like, is it, you know? So,
no, a great, great question. So, usually the big thing, at least for that conference, was what are the students wanting to play? What are mm-hmm. they excited to be? Because that's the key part of it. And the second one for us was we were looking for titles that are also played at the high school level. So, all four of those titles are played at pretty much every high school across the country in some way, shape, or form.
I'm thinking of my son. He's 7 years old, and he loves playing Nintendo Sports, which I'm old, so I keep wanting to call it a Wii, but that's not what it is. You know what I'm talking about, though. But he is getting really good at soccer on there. Is that one of the ones that has ever been played competitively?
Not to my knowledge, mm-hmm. but one of the great things that happens is that a lot of the different groups on campuses will hold tournaments for all kinds of games. Heck, I remember a weightlifting club came in just about a year ago to play a Just Dance tournament and such. So
Oh, that's fun. Love Just Dance.
There's an entire rhythm games club here on campus that competes in everything from Beat Saber to a great example of Guitar Hero or what have you types of games. So the fun thing about esports, much like traditional athletics, is there's lots of different groups that are doing all kinds of things that you might not even realize are sports.
We're talking with John Price, the general manager of Ohio State's esports program. Now, I want to talk to you about what happened in early January. Ohio State hosted a Scholastic Esports Awards. It was the first standalone Scholastic Awards event. So tell me about that. So by Scholastic, was it K-12 or...
Yeah. So we had representatives from every level. So K through 12, two-year institutions, as well as four-year colleges, to include them all, because that's the thing about esports is it's fun. There's so many people doing great work across each one of these areas. And I know many college directors that actively work with high schools, middle schools, even recreation centers in their areas to support them as they develop, whether that be curriculum, whether they're developing competitive teams, or they're just learning more about esports. And so this awards was a chance to really recognize the great work being done in these areas, and also a chance for everyone to come together. And they had a mini conference that went on with it, lots of fun panels, and we also had a high school combine that took place during the event as well.
What tell me about a high school combine.
Oh, yeah. So it was just kind of like those games we were talking about before. People from Rocket League, League of Legends, Overwatch came over to the esports arena over at Lincoln Tower. And for the entire day, these parents, as well as their high schoolers, got to talk with different directors from colleges across the country about possibility signing with them for and getting scholarships and the like. Mm-hmm. And so the first one that's happened here on campus for esports, which was something I've been wanting to do since I got here. So it was really nice to see come to life.
Were they, for this event, were they in teams or individuals?
They were on teams, but it's kind of like the NFL combine sort of thing. They're still being evaluated on those individual levels. How well do they work together with a group of strangers at times? Mm-hmm. They're being put together. Do they communicate? Are they able to plan? And there are some mechanical skill elements, how quickly they can click in different areas, but it's a lot more about the communication and their ability to be part of a team, even if it's just thrown together at the last minute.
Now, this idea of the parents coming and talking about their kids' future in esports, I mean, that has to be kind of new for the parents to wrap their head around. But if they have a kid that's just like really good at it, you want them to know there's a future in it.
Yeah, exactly. And I've seen kind of the gambit since I first started in this field of where first, you know, just like, is my student still going to be able to go to classes? Like, they're not going to just spend all their time playing video games. But now you see parents. I grew up playing wrestling and such, and so we'd go to wrestling meets, and you'd have parents that were on the side screaming, being very enthusiastic. I'm starting to see that for esports, which it still shocked me when I first saw it. But you're seeing parents that have put time and understand the community that they're a part of and what it takes to get to that next level, who are putting in that time and effort just as you would for a traditional athletic parent.
This may be a silly question, but if you're doing competitive esports and you come down to Ohio State to compete, are you allowed to bring your own controller? Is that a silly question?
No, it's like bringing
your own equipment, right?
Yeah. And we have equipment down in our facility, but most of our players and such, they bring their own. We even have lockers so they can store their equipment if they want to leave it there, because it's just like whether it be your gloves or your helmet in football or in soccer, how you tape your legs or what have you. Everyone has their own little ways of doing it. And I've seen some setups that are very unique, but because that's what they're used to, that's what they play on and such.
So Ohio State has a relatively new esports arena. Is that what you were talking about that's in Lincoln Tower?
Yeah. It was built in 2019. It was one of the first one in the Big Ten to be constructed, and it is still kind of one of those marquee facilities out there.
And so it has gaming consoles, gaming computers, virtual reality systems, right? Mm-hmm. Can students use it all the time, or is it just open for any student to use, or you have to be a part of the esports program?
Yeah, no, it's open for any student on campus with a recreational sports membership. So if you take 4 classes on campus or 4 hours of classes on campus, you automatically get access to the space. And we're open 7 days a week. Usually during the week, it's from 4 p.m. until 11 p.m. And on weekends, we're open all the way to midnight. And it gives them the chance to come in. They can play games that we already have provided. We have controllers. We have, like we mentioned, VR. And a lot of time, we host a lot of different events on it. So tournaments, we have a tournament series actually sponsored by Lenovo, where students, if they win first prize, actually get a Lenovo Legion laptop. So we have all these fun events throughout the semester that students can just enter for essentially free.
So there's about 40 higher education institutions in Ohio that have esports programs, right? They're considered an activity, as you said, right?
Yes.
But also, how involved is Ohio State in this? Are you raising your own money, or does Ohio State give you a budget?
We have a budget specifically. Mm-hmm. We're organized under within the Recreational Sports Department through the Office of Student Life, and they've been very supportive since this started. The original kind of plan and such, which included a major back when in 2018 when everything was first proposed, also worked with a variety of other colleges on campuses, including the Engineering College, the College of Arts and Sciences, even the College of Business, just to name three, because I can't remember the other two at the moment.
So what do you see the future of this being? I mean, I guess you would like it to be considered a sport, first of all, instead of an activity.
I think that's definitely part of the journey. But for me, it's kind of my own like bird's eye view of it. It's a lot more than that as well. It is an active community. And that's what a lot of the facilities and ours included is focused on. It's providing a space for students that love video games, love these types of communities to come together and have a place to call home. And so I want it to be a sport, but I also believe that like a healthy growth for the activity in the future is having those spaces so students can come together. They can play with and meet new people that enjoy the same things that they do. And then there's also the entire academic and research element to it. Before I was doing this job full-time, I was actually a professor of communications. And so there's a lot of things in this field that connect back to the classroom that we're already teaching, but we just haven't included what esports is part of that. And there are schools that do have degrees for esports management and for game design and what have you similarly.
And the event you had that was the Scholastic Awards, is that something you hope to do again?
Oh, yes. And actually, planning has already started on that. There's been overwhelming support for the event. It was something that I remember when Chris Postels, who was kind of pitched the idea to me first when we were trying to just figure out what this event would look like back in August of last fall. And it was this idea of not only recognizing the people in the Scholastic space that have done such good work, but giving them a chance to sit down and talk about how do we take it to the next level and providing that stage and an opportunity. So it was when he brought that idea to me, it was not a matter of yes or no, it was a matter of when. And we just happened to make it happen in January this year.
And did you find at that event, you mentioned having spectators, like parents cheering along. So I would think that the spectators would be growing. I mean, I can speak from experience that watching someone else play a video game is popular on YouTube.
Yeah, it really has just continued to grow. And I think I can only see it really improving, just like kind of how traditional athletics began and such at the college level. It happened because you had programs at middle and high school that made this a common expectation, right? So one of the things I always say when on this topic is the next 10 to 20 years is really going to see a level of it that even now we can't even imagine. And that's coming from someone that 10 years ago, remember, was hearing about it when I was working still on the professional side and thinking, I have no idea what that's going to be. And
yeah, and now you're helping run it. Yeah. And how do the games get chosen? Is it purely popularity? Like, this is a game that is fun to play and competitive and hard, so it's actually competitive?
Yeah, popularity is a big part of it. I think another aspect, I know when I'm talking with other leaders that are making these decisions in conferences, is it accessible? Is it something that people can recognize and understand what it means and such, right? But a large of it is like, are the students having fun? Do they want to sit down and play it? And I mean, there's titles from Mario Kart all the way up to traditional like EA Sports college football that happens as well. Mm-hmm. So there's space for all of it. And it's just a matter of finding the space for it sometimes. Like if there are so many clubs on campus already that play different specific titles, it's hard to put them all together.
Well, we've been talking about the esports program at Ohio State, and that is John Price, the general manager of the program. Thanks for being here, John.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Amy.
And we're coming up on Tech Tuesday, we're going to talk about fitness equipment. Is it tracking you? How do you protect yourself? That's when Tech Tuesday continues on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
And you're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is a show where we talk about science, technology, and the future of our environment. If you are a Bowflex user, one thing you might not know is that they have the right to collect and share information on how you smell. Concerns over companies collecting user information typically come up when talking about social media, phones, and the internet. But even your exercise equipment is collecting information about you. Joining us to talk about this is Steve Blair, a Consumer Reports privacy expert. He's been researching the subject. Welcome to All Sides, Steve.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So for those who have a treadmill or an exercise bike at home, if it's connected to the internet, you might expect that it does collect information on things like the amount of time you spend on the machine or the distance you go. However, your research, Steve, has shown that it also collects more than that. What are some things these companies are collecting?
That's absolutely right. You would expect that kind of information related to the workout to be collected, but we were finding things like you mentioned earlier, collection of olfactory data, marital status, dietary habits, hobbies, interests, audio data. And that doesn't include any data from third parties when you connect a peripheral device like a smartwatch or a fitness tracker to the device you're using. And that can include location and sleep data, things like that.
How does my treadmill know if I'm married?
Well, I think you would have to tell it. Yeah. A lot of these devices nowadays are requiring the use of applications and that to connect to, you know, they're connected to the internet for various reasons. And so if they're asking you these questions, this is the kind of data that they're collecting from you.
So in order to get some of these to work, you have to connect to the internet. It's not just, it's not really an option. You have to have the app and it says it just wants you to be able to track your workout and fitness. But I guess it's also asking you a lot of questions when you download the app and get started.
Well, that's absolutely true. And it's unfortunate in that regard as well. You know, I'm from a generation that remembers when you could just ride a bike, right? You didn't have to tell them what your dietary habits were like or if you were looking to start dating. But a lot of these devices are just, they're looking for more and more information because that data is you know, it's valuable.
So a company like Peloton, they got very popular in the pandemic. I know lots of people who added Peloton bikes to their exercise routine. What is a company like that collecting on you?
Specifically, those devices, like a lot of times, like the companies will respond and say, for example, Peloton, they will adhere to the privacy laws, which is great, but they have to adhere to the privacy laws. So that's doing the absolute minimum. You know, we're trying to find that if they are, the concern is that health data and such will be treated the same as anything else, like shopping data, and that's a concern.
Now, if you've connected to an app to be able to use your exercise equipment, is it getting things that you don't even know that it's getting because of other apps on your phone or other permissions? I sometimes find the permissions on the phone very confusing, and I just say allow just to get it out of the way.
Yeah, when you're dealing with an application, it's a whole other layer of data privacy concerns because those apps are usually governed by their own policies. So like you said, they have far more sensors, or they may have far more sensors, the phone, I mean, than the equipment that you're using. So suddenly GPS becomes, you know, potential collection and maybe audio or video or other ad IDs that connect to other applications and allow kind of like a pseudo tracking throughout different applications.
Yeah, audio, that's interesting. So can your exercise bike hear what you're saying while you're working out?
Well, some of these wall-mounted fitness systems we found do collect video and audio because they do utilize a camera. I would imagine for, you know, helping a user with their form or something to that effect. But like that data is ultimately stored somewhere, and that's a different concern altogether.
And at the very beginning, I talked about the equipment knowing how you smell. How does that work? How does it know that?
I have racked my, I've been asked that a lot, and I have racked my brain, and I cannot think of a single reasonable use case for that data.
Okay, so but how does it know? I guess I don't understand how it knows
I
that.
think it seems to me as if it's just a way of saying we collect everything. Here's the five senses. We're taking it all.
Okay, well, the idea of having extra exercise equipment and the exercise equipment getting fancier and fancier, that's important to people. People love. I would think that people really love that their treadmill is so in tune with their body, can really help them get a good workout.
Oh, I agree. The problem is not so much the functionality as much as what's happening in the background, right? So the concern is this data is being sent to somewhere. Well, the question is it being sent in a secure manner to that somewhere, right? And then the next question is, when it's at somewhere, is it being stored according to best security and privacy practices? And then after that, is it being transferred to who? With these privacy policies being so broad, it's really hard to find out where your data will end up and how it's used. And they all go to these different entities. In fact, in one case, we found that your information was being shared with the International Olympic Committee. Not sure why, but maybe they were going to invite you if your workout was good enough.
They're looking for their next star athlete at home on their Peloton.
Exactly.
So these companies, I mean, I would think that some of them are making money off of this, selling your information to advertisers, right?
I would think that as well. Generally speaking, we found that the data is being shared with a variety of different categories of entities, right? Everything from fraud protection companies to tech support to payment processors to government regulators and law enforcement. But then you get into your analytics providers and your advertisers and marketing companies. And that's where it gets or it can get very shady because that's when your data is generally shared with data brokers, which are they collect information on individuals from a wide range of sources and they provide it to other companies for their use.
It reminds me of, I joke around about this, but I'll be talking about something like wanting to buy a new furnace, and then suddenly I get Facebook ads from furnace companies, right? So it's like my phone is always listening to me. I didn't actually look it up. I didn't use the search browser, but I was just talking about it, and suddenly the ad appears. It makes me feel like my workout equipment is going to be doing the same thing, always listening.
Well, you never know. There's so many different data points. There's probably hundreds or possibly thousands that are being sent about you as a user to these different locations. And when they, from all different sources, and when you put that all together, it can paint a pretty good picture of you as far as where you are, what you do, and who, what you're thinking.
Yeah, I could definitely see maybe a treadmill telling Lululemon, like, hey, this lady wears Lululemon pants almost every day, but not every day. You should get her with an ad.
Exactly. They know your shoe size. Well, now you need shoes to match those pants, right?
Yeah, you've had those same shoes for over 3 months. We know that because we can see them. So you should get some new ones.
Yeah, it's a brave new world, apparently.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about exercise technology and what it knows about you with Steve Blair of Consumer Reports, a Consumer Reports privacy expert. So let's talk about what you recommend to protect yourself then. Do we need to actually take the minutes and read the privacy policy before we say yes?
I mean, at Consumer Reports, we do that for you for a variety of products, actually a very wide variety of products. But yeah, you should probably know what's happening. A lot of it's hard to explain, but now you could summarize it with a lot of different tools. Like ultimately, if you're going to use an app or an exercise app in this particular case, check the settings to make sure you're not publicly sharing anything that you don't want to be. For example, on some of these services, we found that your data was public to other users by default. So you would need to like actively change those settings to be private if that's what you were looking to do. And then also disable any features that you're not using or aren't essential because that's going to help to stop any unwanted data exposure as well. And you just have to recognize that these devices and these apps, they're vectors for data collection. So, being able to manage any data collection practices or to maintain control over that is ideal. As far as like any options that they may give you, as far as being able to lead, to correct, or even have access to what they're collecting on you. But honestly, better yet, maybe choose a piece of equipment that doesn't require any data collection at all.
Do they still make pieces of equipment that don't need the internet to you to work, I suppose?
I mean, more and more it looks like that's not the case. It seems like everything wants to be connected these days, right? But again, if you're concerned about companies selling your data or collecting your data, Consumer Reports does have a tool called Permission Slip that works to tell companies to stop selling or delete your information that works on your behalf as an authorized agent. So there are some tools out there that you can utilize that don't work just for one type of category. It's a wide array of companies. So there are tools out there that can do this kind of stuff for you. It's free to use. But yeah, just being aware of that and what you're putting into these, what just be aware of the information you're putting out there, because like you said before, everyone's listening.
So, normally when you download a new app, it'll ask you a question. It'll say, allow to share this data or allow to share my location. And then the second option will be only when using this app. And then the third option is never. Are you recommending never? Because sometimes I pick while using this app because the app needs to know where I am in order to work properly.
Well, as a security and privacy focused individual, I'm a little more paranoid than most people, right? I would suggest professionally, say if you're going to use that and you want it to know that location for a better experience, fine, but only let the app utilize it at that time. Don't give it broad permissions, because if you do, the idea is that it could possibly be tracking you 24/7. Not just when you're utilizing that specific application. So, again, just being aware of the permissions you're giving or access to data, and then when you want them to have that data or expect them to have that data. Just, it shares with other devices, so you have to be aware.
So, what if you go to a gym and use communal exercise equipment? Can it still get my information?
It depends. In some cases, that could be the case, but that's going to vary from unit to unit as far as if that unit has its own connectivity to the internet, or if it's using a different technology, as for example, Bluetooth. If you're not actively connecting your application to it, then you're probably not sharing your information. But it's hard to tell which devices are connected directly to Wi-Fi, or if there's another Bluetooth unit connected to it at all times. It can be difficult to tell depending on the interface of each individual unit.
Yeah, I have to think if you're somewhere like Planet Fitness, where you're just jumping on a treadmill, that's one thing. But if you're in a class like Orange Theory Fitness, for example, you have this heart rate monitor that they sell you, and you're to be a part of the class, your name goes up on the board, and you're all connected together. So it's probably two different situations of what's happening.
Yeah, both of those situations are probably tracking at least some part of your workout. It sounds like the other being a little more intensive than the other.
So you mentioned this earlier, and we are running out of time, but I wanted to be able to ask you about, apps like Apple Health and Google Fit, and everyone is wearing a watch that is always telling them how they're doing exercise-wise. What do we need to be worried about there?
When you connect that type of device to another type of device, both of them are collecting data as well. Both of them may have different sharing, may be sharing with different entities. They may have different policies. And so that's just something to be aware of. Like I said, they're governed by their own policies, different companies, different products. And when you start to connect them all together, what you may think is a decent, you may say, oh, well, Apple protects my data. Well, you may think that, but then when you connect it to a different exercise bike, maybe that's no longer the case. And a lot of different data like that, you can start to infer things rather than getting the information directly as well. And a lot of companies do make inferences on that type of information and sell it to brokers.
Well, I have some hunting to do in the settings in my phone, now, and I have some privacy policies to read. So thank you for that homework, Steve Blair.
Sorry to be of help.
This has been Tech Tuesday, and I want to say thank you to Steve Blair of Consumer Reports. Thanks for being here, Steve.
Thank you so much.
And this has been Tech Tuesday. This is All Sides with Amy Jurevich on 89.7 NPR News.